I'm an operations analyst. Now, I have a hard time describing what that is. But basically, my training is to think of everything as a model. If you know what a model is, I look at Dr. Newman and I have my model of Dr. Newman and how he works. And what happens is, as you go through, as I went through a seminary, I keep revising this model of Dr. Newman, and pretty soon I have my model of how he, you know, how he handles testing, you know, how I respond to his testing, how he handles science and so forth and so on. But basically, I don't have Dr. Newman as a person. I have a model of Dr. Newman. Okay, I have a working model. Okay, well, when I think of myself as a citizen of the country, actually, whatever I do, I as an operations analyst, it's sort of a bias that we live with as ops analysts. We think of everything in terms of models. We think of a government as a model. How do governments work? How can you describe how government works? How do you describe the kind of parameters you can tweak in a government? The talk today is talking particularly about a book by George Orwell, 1984, which was written 35 years ago in 1939, and obviously the title of the book itself gives you a good indication of why that particular book is discussed this year. He talks about a society which is exercises total and absolute control over its citizens in a way that it's not just an external control, not just having people toe the line, so to speak, but the society in 1984 tries to control your very thought processes. So not only do they have to try to force you to toe the line, but you yourself, you know, you don't want to toe the line, or you have no, you wouldn't even think of doing anything else other than toeing the line. And it was written in 1949. George Orwell was not a very popular writer in his time. He was born slightly before World War I. I don't know the exact year, but in any case, he was going through his 20s during the Depression in the 1930s. He considered himself a communist at one time. All his life, as far as I know, he considered himself a socialist, and he associated with socialist causes. But when Stalin began his purges in Russia during the 30s, he became very disillusioned with the outworkings of at least that particular brand of socialism. And he began to sort of strike out into kind of an independent direction in his development of socialism. And his cronies, unfortunately, were still enamored with the Soviet communist line. And so George Orwell became very much isolated. His opinions about communism and about socialism, practical socialism, how it works out, were not well received. He wrote the book Animal Farm in 1945. Animal Farm is a blatant caricature of the Soviet system. I guess my personal feeling is it's medium as a book. I don't think it's the greatest quality book in the world, but it was certainly a influential book, and it still is. I guess I still read it in high school. It's quite common. It characterized the Soviet system as a farm, and it was a very oppressive kind of the way Animal Farm pictures communism as it worked out in Soviet Russia is you started off with a true people's revolution, and then it was taken over by self-serving tyrants, and of course the picture was Russia and the Soviet system. In 1949, he wrote the book 1984 because he was getting a very pessimistic feelings about the direction that society was heading. He could see direct trends in his own society, in Britain, which were very hostile to anything he considered worthwhile or reasonable. And so the book 1984 is very pessimistic. And my interest in it, though, is because, as I say, I like to build models. And I looked at the book 1984 and asked myself, What kind of model of society does this depict? What sort of trends or technological events does it talk about? Are these realistic? Can these things happen? 35 years later, when we look back on his predictions, how many of these are really feasible? How many aren't? And then go from there. So that's where we're going to head tonight. If you haven't read the book 1984, maybe I'll give it a short, or if you haven't read it recently. Although there have been so many reviews about the book 1984 in the past 6 months, if you haven't read the book, or at least read a review which goes over the plot of the book, I would say that you're curiously uncurious. But the book talks about Winston Smith, who's the subject of the book, the hero, so to speak. And Winston Smith is, we're plunked right into the middle of this this oppressive totalitarian state. It happens to be London, set in London at this time. And the world is divided into actually three competing states, all of which I believe are more or less totalitarian. The whole world has pretty much evolved into this direction. And these three states are continually vying with each other for power, because as you learn throughout the book, the whole idea of this is that there's a power elite in each of these states who wants to remain in charge. They want everybody else to the line so that they can be in power. The lust for power is the dominating theme. Anyway, George is in this state. The state uses technical means to keep people in line and to force people into obedience to the state. Winston Smith himself works in the Ministry of Truth. His job is to edit history. As events occur, occasionally there will be contradictions in what the party does as compared with what history said they were going to do. And so his job is to change history so history agrees with what the current party line is. So, for example, if they were making projections about what the chocolate rations were going to be 3 years hence, and then they were congratulating themselves for meeting the chocolate rations quota and exceeding the quota, and it turned out that, in fact, they only got half the way there, they revised their previous speech, which they made projections of the quota, and so it shows that they actually did better than they claimed they were going to do. So his job was revising history. And he apparently was not a very good student of the system, because he has these, he's harboring these thoughts, which are seditious thoughts as far as the system is concerned. And the whole story goes around how he develops these seditious thoughts. Eventually he is caught, and it turns out that the system he is working for is so pervasive that really the system that he was really feeding into the hands of the system in some of his seditious action, and they knew he was being seditious and they were just trying to catch him and so on. There are a number of technical things that happen in the book which I've been talking about. They exact total control of the citizens. First, they have physical control, and they achieve this by a kind of a total surveillance. You walk into your apartment room, and there's this video screen in that room, which is a two-way screen, so that you can see it, it can see you. It's broadcasting propaganda all the time, but in particular, it is a means for the state to keep track of you, okay? So they can track your movements at all times. So you're under a situation of total surveillance. Now, you don't really have total surveillance, but the thing is, you never know when you're being surveilled and when you aren't. And so the story actually opens up with Winston going into his apartment, and then it describes that his particular apartment is so arranged that the televideo screen, which can only can only intercept him or see him when he's within its vision. And his apartment is so constructed that there's a little alcove to the side where he goes when he wants to escape the screen, And in this alcove, he's keeping a diary. A diary is an illegal document. I mean, there's nothing illegal. Pardon me, there's nothing illegal in the system because there are no laws. But he, as is explained, he feels if his diary was apprehended, that he would no doubt be killed for it, I mean, put to death for having a diary. Why? Because I guess that would be recording history in a way that is not acceptable. So there's this the concept of physical surveillance. Then there is a concept of social control. Social control takes the form of many forms. One is that there is a enforced impersonal relationship between all people. He's working in a cubicle. He doesn't even know the names of the people on either side. Okay? When he goes through the hall, you don't converse with people. You just take a totally impersonal attitude towards things. Your life is so tied up in the party and going to party rallies and so forth and so on, that there is no opportunity to have any social life of your own. Normal family relationships, love and affection and so forth, are absolutely discouraged. There is no such thing as a family in the usual sense of the word. You can get married, you can have children, but the whole concept of affection and so forth is absent. So there's this type of social control, and then there's a psychological control, and the psychological control is exercised in a number of ways. One way, for example, is in the language. They have a their concept is to control the richness of the language so that it will make it impossible to think, basically, or to make it impossible to think in more than very elementary ways. So there's a language that they're creating called newspeak. A newspeak is a language in which all abstract concepts are removed. And there are only the concrete, very simple, basic words. And the idea, one of the things that's going on in the book is they're building a dictionary of the newspeak language. And they're getting the 13th revised dictionary edition and so forth of the dictionary. And the idea is to so strip the language of any meaning that that you can't harbor seditious thoughts, basically. There are other aspects. There's the aspect of doublethink, where you take a concept and you fill the concept with both the meaning and its opposite, and that's the concept. So, for example, the Ministry of Peace, its job is to conduct war. The Ministry of Truth, its job is to tell lies, basically. And the Ministry of Plenty, would control, would enforce poverty, I guess you could say. One of the psychological mechanisms for controlling the people is to get them to believe whatever the party says, even at the same time hold opposing concepts in your mind and somehow believe both of them, both the fact and the contrary. So you can see that the state is enforcing itself by means of great technical feats. And of course you ask yourself to what extent these things are possible. Now there's another book that I have called A Future Shock by Alvin Toffler that was also in the, it was a very catchy phrase, Future Shock. Future Shock is a very different kind of a book. It's not an apocalyptic book like 1984, but it takes up themes of modern society and basically says how man is, how modern society is moving, and makes statements about how we adapt to the society. It's not it's not intended to be a forewarning of evil or anything like that, but it's just stating the fact that this society, for example, is a, for example, one of the themes is the death of permanence. Everything now is temporary instead of permanent. You don't have roots anymore. Themes of that sort. The throwaway society, the limits of adaptability. He talks about one of the big problems in modern society is that we have an overabundance of choice. We can do too many things, and so we don't know what to do. We go crazy because we don't know what to do. Another look at society from the viewpoint trying to characterize it in a few terms. Now, okay, what I want to do is go through first some of the technical features of the book 1984 in particular, and to a certain extent Future Shock, and evaluate some of these technical features from the viewpoint of 35 years later. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about the Christian response to some of these things. First, the subject of technology, especially the surveillance issue in 1984. To me, because I'm in computers and so forth, it's a very interesting technical question. Is it possible to have a society in which you can control people by total surveillance? And very interestingly, I just also picked up a book called The Puzzle Palace, which is about a year old now, and it has some amazing things talking about the exact topic of surveillance by none other than our friendly National Security Agency. And he goes into some of the ways that surveillance can occur, can be done. Now, the problem with total surveillance, I mean, just total exhaustive surveillance, you know, somebody watching you every minute of your day and doing it automatically is just a matter of information. I mean, just too much information to keep track of. But the point is, you don't really have to keep total track of a person in order to know what they're doing, at least to the point of finding out whether they're being seditious or not. The National Security Agency's approach is this. The National Security Agency, according to this book, which I believe is true, monitors all international telephone calls. We don't know whether they monitor the domestic ones or not, but they're not supposed to, okay? They monitor all international telephone calls. They say, how in the world can we do that? Well, the way they monitor it is, number one, how do they physically tap in? Well, it's because they have a little trouble with underwater lines, but satellites is easy because the satellites just have a dish right near the satellite receiving station, and then they just intercept the call. What do they mean by monitoring the call? What they do is they have in their computers what they call keywords or key phrases or key thoughts or key concepts. And what they do is they scan all phone conversations electronically looking for key phrases, like President Reagan, okay? And if they see President Reagan, then the computer automatically takes that snatch of the telephone conversation and records it, okay? So literally, you know, somebody talking about the stock market price, they're not going to record that. But if somebody's talking about President Reagan or somebody's talking about Washington, D.C., or somebody's talking, or they can entrap particular phone calls. Any phone calls, for example, my first job was at the submarine base in Groton, Connecticut. That's area code 203-449. Okay, 449 is the prefix, like four digits. Now, if we're thinking of the Russians, they incidentally have an intercept station on Long Island. We were very kindly providing with this. It's perfectly feasible for them to intercept every phone call that has 203-449 plus something, okay? And by doing that, then they can maybe they track those phone calls, and then they can look for keywords or key thoughts or key concepts and do surveillance that way. So it is technically possible to do automatically a vast amount of electronic surveillance. Now, in the particular case of Winston Smith, it didn't say how the surveillance was done. It didn't say whether there was somebody sitting at a screen at the other end looking at Winston Smith, or maybe had a monitor with 100 screens on it and was looking, just sort of scanning them out or what. But it occurred to me as an ops analyst that Winston Smith was making a very drastic mistake in that there's such a thing as negative information when you're talking about artificial intelligence and processing. And the negative information is, you know, Winston Smith is in the room, but he's not within view. Now, you know, it doesn't take very much intelligence to see if this is a consistent pattern that he must be trying to hide. So, you know, by using negative information in particular case of Winston Smith, it's a dead giveaway that the guy is trying to hide. If there was only one place that he could possibly hide, that was this little alcove. What's he spending hours and hours in that alcove for? Okay. So I think Winston Smith might have committed a very bad mistake in that particular case. So anyway, surveillance, I believe, is technically possible. Total surveillance, okay. You might ask yourself, what is the case in the closed societies today? Well, the interesting thing is the closed societies today, by and large, are relatively backwards technologically. But I think things are going to change in the next, let's say, 5 to 20 years. I had a friend, I have a student who works for me. He's at Drexel right now, but oftentimes he works for me at my company. And he was talking about, he was sort of, you know, saying about how the personal computer market was exploding, and they were talking, they were putting more and more capacity on these chips, and they were having more and more memory, and he was saying, you know, you can do practically everything you want to now. What in the world's the use of, you know, what are we going to do with 10 times the capability? And my comment to that was, on the contrary, I think that the computer age is just starting to dawn. And we are just starting to get to the place where we can really do things with computers. Look at it this way. I just saw an ad 2 days ago for a laser disc. It's an 8-inch disc, and they now have lasers to use to record data. A floppy disk with lasers. 8-inch disc had capacity, two-sided capacity of 4.6 gigabits of memory. Now, 4.6 doesn't mean anything to you, except that that means you can put the entire Encyclopedia Britannica, including all the blanks and so forth and so on those two discs. Just one little thing. Okay, what?
Two sides.
In fact, I calculated 24 volumes, 1,000 pages per volume, two columns, 66 lines per page. Per column, 66 characters per line. Multiply that all out, and it comes out. And then 6 characters per 6 bits per character, and it comes out to almost exactly that. Well, you say, well, suppose I had a modest-sized library or a modest-sized database, and I wanted to keep track of the information in that database. What would you need? The answer is you'd need billions and billions and billions of different storage. Billions and billions. So we're just barely getting to that point now. Just today, okay, we're just getting to the point where we can put these things on readily accessible disks. And, of course, the processing power required to handle that is fairly enormous, too. But my guess is the things are going to the point now, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, it'll really be possible to do total surveillance in some reasonable sense, in the sense of information processing. So I think that the surveillance that he's talking about is technically possible. Now the next question comes to psychological control. Now I must admit that I am a kind of biased in this area because I'm a technical person, and I always consider psychology as kind of a pseudoscience. But let's take the subjects that are mentioned in the book. One point that I think he's wrong on, and I think that he makes it sound too easy to really control the human mind. Now, the items that he uses to control the human mind, I think, are valid techniques. Newspeak, the idea of minimizing the language, taking out the abstract words out of a language. Now, when I first started looking at this stuff, I sort of debunked that idea, and I said, that doesn't make much sense. You know, how could that possibly keep a person from thinking, to take the words out of the language? And then I heard people talking. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we had a missionary in our church from New Tribes Mission talking about one of their biggest problems in translating Scripture was that this particular language they were working in had no abstract concepts. Everything was concrete. It wasn't it wasn't love. It was I love you, or you know, it had no abstract concepts, and so you know, that got me to thinking that, you know, it might be possible if you really remove abstract concepts that you would limit a person's ability to think. But then You say, yes, but they did convey the gospel to this tribe. So they somehow did it without that language, okay, without those abstract words. I think I still maintain my original position. I think people overstate the power of language per se as a vehicle for conveying thoughts. Incidentally, you can't blame George Orwell if he overstated the case as far as brainwashing and so forth goes, because in the area of artificial intelligence, there has been a dramatic change in just the last 20 or 30 years of history of artificial intelligence in the conception of what people think they can do as far as duplicating what the brain does. Just today, an article was a theme. This is from Science magazine, I believe. Yeah, Science. Just came out today talking about the current state of artificial intelligence. And I thought it was very relevant to tonight, so I thought I'd mention it. The main thing that AI researchers have gained on the theoretical front is a certain humility. An appreciation of how awesomely complex the most ordinary human act can be, and of just how much a computer has to know before it can do much of anything. And then it talks about historically AI was the product of World War II ferment of information theory, control theory, and so forth and so on. And it says those were the days when everything seemed possible. In other words, the idea was that eventually you would be able to have a computer duplicate the thought processes, and then we'd have machines thinking as strong as people, as well as people. But the current thought is, see, in order to even think that you can somehow duplicate the brain with a computer, you have to believe that the brain operates in some fashion, something like a computer. In other words, it stores things, it operates sequentially, or it operates maybe in parallel, but at least there are sequential identified operations that has a deductive process to it. Whereas more and more, I believe, people today are beginning to think that the mind doesn't really work that way at all, that the mind really, in some strange way, works inductively in what it does. It, of course, you'll get my biases now. It thinks in terms of models. Okay, the computer, the brain, instead of taking facts and then deducing conclusions, takes facts and induces conclusions and induces models that describe those things. In other words, when I see a chair, this is getting back to Plato now. When I see a chair, the brain doesn't say chair is these many pieces of wood put together and so forth. The brain has a model of a chair, a concept of a chair, and. So if that's the case, then perhaps it is a lot more difficult to really control the psychological processes than would be thought of in 1984. There certainly is something to brainwashing. I think that most people will admit to this nowadays that you can achieve amazing things by total control of the environment and conditioning of a person. It takes a great a lot of effort to achieve total control. Social isolation certainly will do something. Enforced poverty, that was another concept that was mentioned in the book. By keeping everybody on a very low plane of existence, you kept everybody dependent on the state for what they were going to do. This is apparently, I believe this would be a very effective way of controlling people. And in fact, it was a deliberate policy of the state there. Now, I want to make some comments about the 1984 theories. I think there is one fundamental error that the book 1984 makes, and I think this error is relevant to the Christian. And that is, I believe the 1984 scenario is too neat a package. In the 1984 scenario, the state has total control, and it's a stable system. It's a system in which technology, working in many fronts, it works in the front of the language, it works with in social relationships, it works in surveillance. But all these things work together to produce a total control of a situation in a totalitarian state. I think that one of the big mistakes that secular people make today is that they believe that it is possible for secular technology to lead to an equilibrium state, whether it's good or bad. In the case of 1984, it's bad. Whereas I believe that when a Christian sees a closed system described in which technology is able to solve the problems apart from God, I think you ought to see, you know, ought to raise warning flags. Because I believe it is a fundamental principle of Christianity that Christ is an integral part in keeping the world together, so to speak. There's two passages in the New Testament that I know of immediately that talk about this. Colossians 1:17 talks about, in him all things hold together. The word is synesthikon, to stand together, or Lemsky says they have their permanence in him. And in Hebrews 1:3, it talks about Christ sustaining all things by his powerful word in the NIV. And the word translated sustaining is pharontes, bearing. The word means bearing all things with the power of his word. Most people that I know of, and maybe Dr. Newman has alternative interpretations, but most people I know interpret these as saying, at least for the believer, that Christ not only was involved in the creation, but Christ is involved in a fundamental way in keeping things going. Now, I suppose you might say keeping things going means setting up the rules and letting the things, giving things a kick and letting them move. But I believe for the Christian, it means a lot more than that. And I personally feel that this is a commentary on humankind's ability to set up a system and have it work as a closed system. I believe that's a contradiction. A secular system cannot work by itself. One of the most interesting commentaries that I think of, and when I think of evolution, is that evolution, to a secular scientist, is a is an illustration of how a closed system working only by rules of chance or rules of physics and science produces great order and great harmony. And I guess my opinion is that's a disconceit. That's a conceit of secular science. That in fact, you wouldn't get anything like that harmony or like that order apart from God's involvement. But so when we're talking about a Christian coming to something like 1984, or when we talk about a Christian coming to any theory of society, I think you will see in any secular theory of society anyway, a claim that you can achieve a self-sustaining closed society, or a closed or open, a self-sustaining society in a state of equilibrium, okay? In other words, not going off the deep end one way or another, from totally secular mechanisms. Okay, you understand what I'm saying here? And I believe for the Christian, they would disbelieve that. I think the Christian has got to disbelieve that. And I would like to now spend the rest of this talk going over some trends and tendencies, partly reflecting 1984 and partly from my own observations of society, and trying to interpret what I see in society from the viewpoint of a Christian, that if you want to approach this thing from purely secular viewpoint, you're in deep trouble, okay? I hope that makes some kind of sense. Incidentally, you might ask yourself, well, if 1984 was wrong, if we aren't today in 1984, should we pay any attention to it at all? Or can we predict what the life will be, what the world will be like in 20 or 30 years? And the thing I can say about that is there are conflicting trends in society. There are trends, for example, in United States society which would lead towards greater control. But then there are other trends which would lead away from greater control. There are trends which would lead to a disaster scenario, like nuclear holocaust, which could happen. But then there are trends which would lead to a sort of a normalcy scenario. We have somehow avoided nuclear holocaust, and we end up with a society that controls poverty, reduces disease, liberates us from drudgery, and so forth and so on. So I believe it's basically impossible to predict with confidence what direction future society is going to take. But what you can see is the tendency of certain trends, and you can react to those. Now, for example, a disaster scenario. One scenario would be a nuclear holocaust. Nobody can say that's not a plausible scenario unless God intervenes and prevents it from happening. There's nothing that would say that's not a plausible scenario. Now, the interesting thing about the nuclear holocaust scenario is what secular scientists do with it. And I think this is another case where... I'm going to really betray my prejudices now. Because I think that those of you who have been reading the science literature or the news in the last 6 months are aware of the scenario called the nuclear winter scenario, which is being pushed by Carl Sagan and others. Let me give you my interpretation of what they're doing and why. You have secular scientists who are horrified by the prospects of nuclear war. And so they're saying to themselves, what can we do to prevent the political leaders from even thinking about a nuclear war? Okay? And their answer is, if we can invent a scenario developed scientifically, which is so horrendous that everybody loses, then maybe we can persuade political scientists to not consider that as a scenario. I think that is exactly what the nuclear winter is. There are other scenarios, there are other books out on the effects of a nuclear war. The interesting thing is, during the 50s and the 60s, there were a number of think tanks. Herman Kahn is one well-known person who worked in that area, which exhaustively studied the subject of nuclear war. And they concluded at that time that basically a nuclear war is horrible, but basically you'd live through it in one way or another. Now, we know more probably about the effects of nuclear radiation now than we did then. But I don't think that we have gained the capability scientifically to analyze the complexities of the nuclear war scenario well enough to come up with the kind of statements that Sagan's made. Why did he make that statement? Because they desperately want to have a scientific way of saying that this scenario, don't do it, it can't be done. I certainly sympathize with their desire. I think that their means is sort of it's a symptom of having come to a point at which secular science can't handle it anymore, and not admitting God, not invoking God as a possible alternative, and saying, let's see what we can do to take the law into our own hands, so to speak. I guess my feeling is a nuclear war would be disaster. But every scenario I have seen of the sort of Sagan, and I've looked at them and I've studied them a little bit, they all make great extrapolations of things. For example, one scenario says all the refineries that we would, for almost over a year, there would be mass starvation for over a year, and one of the reasons is because we rely on public transportation, which relies on gasoline. All the refineries would be destroyed, and there would be no gasoline. Well, you know, that, number one, it doesn't take a year in an emergency to build a refinery, number one. The pipelines will not be destroyed, by and large. Plus, almost all of the gas we have is stored underground. And except for the stuff in the major urban areas, there would be lots of gas in there. Okay, I don't want to get into that. To me, the Sagan type of reviews are typical of secular scientists grasping at a straw, trying to invoke a kind of stability into a situation which is basically unstable without God's intervention or without God's help. That's my assessment of it. Another scenario would be a starvation scenario. Another scenario is a disaster scenario, basically population growth beyond the food supplies. Another scenario would be an energy brownout. Another scenario would be a totalitarian state of the 1984 type. And then on the other side, any of those scenarios that could occur, and incidentally, about 5 years ago, it was in the vogue to talk about these starvation scenarios in which what you do, the model is very simple. You just say, well, the population is growing 2% per year, and so by, increase 2% per year, and by 2043, there will be 1 square foot per adult. And so, obviously things will come to a crisis. When that happens, we won't be able to get food. We won't have enough room to farm. I have to stay inside if somebody can plow the field. Well, the fact is, what that really says is the model's no good. Okay, what that really says is there ain't going to be exponential growth of 2% per year. Something's going to happen. In fact, things are happening. Now, the problem there is to address the real problem of overpopulation. The countries which deny God use other mechanisms which are equally drastic or very drastic. There was there was a movie on public television about a month ago on China, in which they talked about family planning in China and abortion and so forth. It was a very moving documentary. And basically, the dilemma that was stated there was China, incidentally, is trying to enforce a very rigid rule, one child per family, okay? And the story was basically, or part of the story was about this family who had a second child coming. And that there was a lot of pressure to abort the child. And finally, at 6 months, it was aborted. And, you say that's horrible. But then on the other hand, you say, China looks at it from a very cold-blooded manner. They say, look, if we continue our population growth the way we are, that 1 square foot scenario is going to be true. What they say basically is, if we have one child per family on the average, then in 30 years, here's our population, and we will have prosperity. If we increase at 1.5 per family, then it's going to stabilize at this, and we'll have rampant poverty, or 1.6, or whatever it is. More than 2 per family, it explodes. So China is addressing in a secular way a very real problem. And what I'm arguing is, from my Christian perspective, those kinds of draconian moves are inevitable if you insist on a total secular interpretation or evaluation or solution to your problems. Now, I wanted to spend the next time, I got 10 more minutes, and I wanted to spend a say a few things about some things that are happening in our society today. To put it as, I have a Korean son. So, and the symbol on the Korean flag is the yin and the yang. And I guess basically I would summarize my assertion about the basic instability of secular societies is that there is no yin and yang, that they don't balance out, okay? And one of the things we want to do as Christians is be aware of where things are heading and aware, I believe, of the fact that things do head towards a basic instability, not a stability. Anticipate what the consequences are and see what we would do about it as a Christian. For example, I think our society is getting to the point where they are increasingly being forced to make godlike decisions. Decisions, let's put it this way, which not too long previously were left to God. And life and death decisions about who's going to live, who's going to die. And, you know, whatever else you want to say about it, the one thing that really disturbs me about this is the more God-like decisions that you make, the more debased your view of life is, I think. I remember seeing a film, again, this was, I think, in a Christian context, of an abortion clinic. And at one point, there was a discussion with one of the surgeons of the abortion clinic. And, you know, you could just sort of get the feeling that, you know, he just basically despised the whole situation. I mean, he didn't think very much about the life that he was taking, and he probably didn't think very much about the women he was working with either, as far as you could tell. In other words, you got the feeling of total callousness on the part of this person. Take some situation like, now again, I'll tread on toes, the Beirut bombing. The Marines are withdrawing from Beirut. We're supposed to be a peacekeeping force, which means you're not supposed to take sides. And then all of a sudden we're shelling the Syrians for no particular reason, as far as I could tell. You know, well, never mind. You know, the point is the ability to just sort of, in a sort of a cold-blooded way, talk about shelling where you're killing people, and just sort of talk about it in sort of a cold-blooded way, strikes me as a making God-like decisions in sort of a calloused way. But the points I wanted to make, the points I mentioned in the abstract of the talk, are the dilemmas that we get in because of the progresses of medicine and so forth. We have the capability, for example, we're rapidly getting the capability of curing disease, but there's a serious question in scientists' minds as to whether we can ever cure the aging factor. Aging is a very perplexing thing, from my understanding, reading the popular science magazines about it. One theory is that aging is basically a problem of progressive pollution of your either the DNA or your genetic cells or of your just the cells in your body. And, you know, as you live, you gradually get pollutants building up into your body, and eventually you age. Well, you can cure diseases all you like, but that doesn't necessarily give you the capability to cure aging. So here's the dilemma. You have people, and I have a grandmother, for example, who is very old, and you end up with a lot of centenarians or 100-year-old people or very old people who basically don't want to go on living. They've had it. They're old. They can't do things they could do. And isn't this sort of a dilemma of science now? You've cured disease. You can't cure aging. So you end up with a lot of old people who basically have had it, would just as soon go. And the graceful ways of going are gone. I again attribute that to a kind of a dilemma that a secular approach to things ends up with. In the area of social legislation, one of the interesting things about social versus democratic societies that's happened. I've been reading literature about the Soviet system, economic system. Again, I'm interested in the models of things. And the interesting thing is, in the 50s, the discussions about the Soviet system basically revolved around the ideologies, the ideological differences. But in the last 5 years now, I don't know if it's because people are polite or because you can't talk about ideologies when you deny any kind of moral and so forth and so on. I don't know what the reason is. But in the past couple of 3 years, the books about Soviet society tend to talk about not the ideology of the Soviet system, but about the basic unworkability of central planning. In other words, the Soviet system is built around the concept of being able to control things from the top. And what they're discovering, or what analysts, Western analysts at least, of the Soviet society are discovering is that It is just not possible to control a complex society from the top. Now, the real dilemma is, what's going to happen to civil society? And I think from the Christian viewpoint, we should be very concerned, because I believe that what is happening is the Soviet system is again trying to solve the problem in a secular way that can't be solved without God in the equation. And so they're heading for a disequilibrium. And there are many Soviet watchers today who say that the situation in Soviet Russia is really grave right now. And basically the reason is because they have an unworkable system and they're afraid to do anything about it. One of the reasons, for example, that has been given why they weren't able to elect a premier who was anything other than just about on his deathbed was because they're sort of hogtied. They can't do anything. One analysis of the Korean KAL airline situation, incidentally, I hope you'll pray that it doesn't happen soon, because my son Andrew is going to go to Korea on that flight, on that path, not that path, hopefully, in about another month. So I sincerely hope that he's not. In fact, he was asking about life insurance. I said, look, it doesn't really matter. My personal assessment of that situation is that what it really reflects is the fact that the Soviet government is out of control of the military. That really what happened was the military took the law into their own hands. And that is, in fact, one theory of the Soviet military system, which, incidentally, that's another subject which I know something about, which is not the subject tonight, but the differences between the military system of the Soviets and the military system of the Americans. And one feature of the Soviet military system is decentralization of control in a very scary way. For example, the feeling is the Soviet military has sort of a tripwire concept, that if you transgress, boom. That's about that simple. So you transgress the airspace, boom. The attack occurs. Whereas, and unfortunately, the feeling is that they have the same concept about nuclear release, too. So that under, if you trip the certain wire, the weapons go off. That's one analysis by a knowledgeable person. Whereas the U.S. system is very much not that way. The U.S. system does not take action based on just crossing the tripwire. In fact, another event that has occurred in the last month or two, associated with the deployment of the Pershing 2 missiles in Europe, was the concept of shoot on warning, firing on warning. Does that phrase make sense to you? It was in the news in the last couple, 3 months. I have a trouble because sometimes I see certain phrases which I know about, and so they mean something to me, and other people just sort of pass it over and they don't think about them. But at one point, there was a discussion for about 2 or 3 weeks of great concern that what might happen is we might be precipitated into a war by some automatic system which would go off and say, hey, they're coming, and we'd shoot all the weapons, and it's called firearm warning, shoot on warning. Well, from my experience, I knew that was not at all part of the American military system. In fact, I can even give you a story about, I don't know what we're talking about this point, this is not the point of the talk, but it's interesting. I can give a story about how there was a submarine defensive system which was trying to address the problem that under certain circumstances things would happen so fast that you couldn't make any deliberative action, so therefore the system was going to work automatically. And it was killed, I mean the system was never built, for exactly that reason, that no matter how dangerous it is, the American military will not do something just on warning. Now, if that's because they disbelieve automatic systems, I don't know. But the scare is that maybe the Soviet system will. Another trend in modern society is the trend towards greater dependency on the public dole. Now, another thing that is that has struck me, and, you know, as I grow, I guess I learn things. And that is that many of the situations we have economically today are the direct result of having depended on the government to do something some time ago. You may or may not be sensitive to the farm policy problems, but it's a good illustration, the dairy support problems. The government says, the farmers say, we're in financial trouble. The government says, oh, that's all right, we'll lend you money at low rates, low interest rates. So the farmers borrow money. And then sometime later, the interest rates go up, and the farmers say, we're in trouble. And the government says, we'll protect you, and so forth and so on. There's a story in To Tell Me a Story series called Roz the Evil Moneylender. And the whole idea of the story is that you don't borrow money unless you can pay it back. And I personally think that one of the trends in modern society is a push for the general person to become more and more dependent on the public dole, or more and more dependent on things continuing as they are in order to survive. That strikes me as a trend in modern society, which Christians should watch out about. Cost push. As we get more knowledgeable in medical capabilities, we're able to do more. We're able to prolong life arbitrarily long. We're able to perform medical treatments. And because we're a democratic society, these treatments have to be freely available to everybody. And what happens is things get so incredibly expensive that arbitrary decisions have to be made. In Great Britain, it is, for example, there are age limits beyond which you can't get, for example, an organ transplant. I believe the age limit is like 55. And what happens is you have good causes, and these good causes are then carried to the point where they force the government to make choices which formerly were left to God to make. And because we're in a secular society which denies God, therefore the government makes those decisions, and it's the worst of all of us. The final comment I wanted to make was about socialization. It's amazing to me how people accept socialism as somehow being good as an alternative democracy to capitalism. And I think it's interesting to just observe the ways things can go when you try to use central planning. My favorite example of socialist capitalist is the Mexican oil situation. But I had another quote, which shows how the government doing something can really start off with good intentions and end up kind of crazy. And I'll have to close on this. UNESCO's crisis is for us all. It's talking about, this is in Nature magazine about a month ago, it's talking about a vivid illustration of the mischief that can be done when people set out to translate good but ill-defined intentions into rules that the whole world is then expected to follow. One of the problems with trying to solve things from a bureaucracy is that if you have a problem area in which there's a whole spectrum of possible responses, a bureaucracy has to have a specific response. Okay? So you translate a spectrum of responses into a yes, no, a very specific response, which to me says try to avoid bureaucracies as much as possible. Now, the subject here is UNESCO's attempt to ensure fair treatment of free speech and news dissemination throughout the world. The argument is going like this. Free speech is a common good, right? Of course. So everybody should be free to communicate, right? Well, yes. But it's not like that because the world's successful news agencies and television networks are mostly owned by capitalists who put out distorted information about the countries against which they are prejudiced, but which lack the means to answer back. So, should there not be some way in which governments not in control of the international news agencies or television networks can influence what is said about them by others? And in the meantime, should not journalists operating internationally be licensed by those about whom they should write? UNESCO's remedy, this is their analysis, UNESCO's remedy would be worse than the disease it's meant to cure. To regard as synonymous the principle of free speech for people and the doctrine of information control by governments is, in 1984 language, doublespeak. And it goes on to say that what UNESCO is trying to do in order to foster free dissemination of true free speech throughout the world, recognizing that the people who are disseminating it have biases, is to institute controls in the free speech so that true free speech will occur. Of course, the problem there is that it's free according to somebody's interpretation of free. Well, okay, I discussed the book 1984 to a certain extent. What I was hoping to do tonight was discuss 1984 in the context of trends and the sorts of events in society that can occur. I tried to make one principal theme as far as Christian response goes, and that is that I believe from a Christian viewpoint, a basic comment that can be made about secular systems is that they are unstable, and that if left to their own devices, they will lead to unsavory consequences. And I believe that the 1984 is one example. There are many other examples. I believe when the Christian looks at secular societies, as I think they should look with an understanding view, but with a view that the basic fallacy here, the basic malady, is the denial of God and his claims. And the results then are putting yourself into circumstances where you have to make God-like decisions, and that is very unattractive. Okay.
Okay, questions.
Yeah.
How stable or unstable do you see the Antichrist system as being? The reason I ask is two comments that are made in the scripture, Paul saying that at that time people are going to say peace and safety. And Jesus says at that time they'll be marrying and giving in marriage. So it sounds like it's a safe type of time with the normal activities going on.
I believe personally that the 1984 society, as an example, can be stable in the short run, but not in the long run. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're talking about a relatively short time.
Yeah.
I think facilities.
The Lord's going to intervene and.
Yes.
Perturb yes. that system rather severely.
Rather severely.
So I'm thinking about the idea of non-believers, the idea of a godless society still having a certain kind of stability. You're just saying it's not a permanent type of thing.
It's not a permanent type of thing. It is indeed. Okay, another theme that you can fight is that the imbalance of technology. There is the capability, I believe, coming very soon to have almost total surveillance in a closed society. Okay, given that we're already a closed society in some fashion, almost total surveillance. But I believe there is not the capacity to have total control over people's minds as well as their physical circumstances. But now it takes a while for insurrection to arise, to take place. And the Soviet system, unfortunately, has come to the point where that time is passing. Okay, they're getting to the point where that total control, which has been exercised very effectively for about 50 years now, is about coming to the end of its limits. I mean, you can only control things so much. At least that's my interpretation. Of course, I am notoriously bad at interpreting. You know, one of the interesting exercises you do is you think back, you put yourself in your shoes 10 years ago and say, what was my outlook on the future at that time? Go back 20 years. What was my outlook on the future at that time? And it's amazing how it changes. Frankly, in 1970, I am very, very pessimistic about what was going to happen during the 70s. Because we were in the middle of this burning down the universities and, all that malarkey. In the 60s, I don't hardly remember that far. But it was a very, very optimistic kind of outlook and thing. In 1970, I would have said it would be impossible to have a conservative president, Clinton Jones. But never mind that. have a move towards trying to control the explosion of social services. I mean, there are things that have happened in the last 5 years you'd say would be impossible. Would have been impossible. So your outlook tends to change as time passes. My present outlook is, present opinion is that I think the Soviet system is just about at the end of its rope without fundamental changes. And I think that the pollution is catching up with them, I guess you might say. But there is the capability in the short run to exercise an imbalanced kind of control. One of the theories of society, of history is that history is a record of one technological imbalance being followed by another one. For example, you compare World War I with World War II. World War I was a situation in which there was a very highly technologically developed capability to defend yourself, but the offensive capability militarily was not there. So therefore you had very bloody countries. World War II, there was much less blood in the front lines because the offensive capability had caught up to the defensive. In effect, I guess it was the offensive capability. But there's a theory, society that things just go from one imbalance to another without equilibrium. And I think that's basically true.
It also seems that, as you look at what the scriptures say about the way things are going, that the total control is not going to be that necessary because deception is going to come into it. But people will be controlled through deception, not through fear of punishment as a result of disobeying. At least that's the concept I get when I look at the Antichrist reign and his false prophet. Again, it's the power to deceive and in that way make people want to obey, to marvel after the system, in which case there is no need to have this kind of rigid control over that kind of a system.
The difference between 1984 and Future Shock is that in Future Shock, the system that they have is a voluntary system, and in 1984 is a closed system. Mm-hmm. That seems to be developed. Also, I guess it would develop the theme that, and the Antichrist, really, he is playing on the religious coming through the people. Whereas the secular society tends to try, pretends at least, to deny the religious side, okay? But Antichrist maybe is a little smarter, and he says, people do have a religious nature, and let's capitalize on that.
I think he can predict the technology advances are going to happen in the next 10, 15, 20 years. But I don't think he can predict the uncertainty of society, what's going to happen tomorrow, the next day. You've got a Russian aircraft carrier tomorrow, something happens to Vance out of that. You've got the Gaddafi's of Libya, you've got the guy in Iran, there's so many, you've got the Central American oil situation. You got all these fires all over the world, and they could all blow up at different times. This Russian thing, my wife tuned me into a 5:30 morning evangelist from Oklahoma to wake me up in the morning. He was talking about Russia and saying that Russia will be coming down to Judea in the next year. That'd be the end times. This is the Bible predicts, the power coming down from the north. This can happen in what you're saying because Russia has reached its end result and they try some things that are even pushing a button.
I think the evidence, in fact, it's amazing to me how at least the Soviet lookers, watchers that I see, are also saying, I mean, there's hardly anybody who says the Soviet system is a great system. I mean, 10 years ago, people were saying, man, they really got control of it, 20 years ago at least. But less and less are saying that.
Well, Russia now, you got the old versus the young, that's what's happening. The old timers are trying to hold on, and once they all die off, then the young generation's going to get in.
And then what's going to happen?
Well, then it's going to happen. That's why they keep putting older men in there.
But maybe that is the start of the apocalypse, the fact that the Soviet system has gotten, one great way to rally the people is to have a good war, and maybe that's the way to do it.
And they're very sensitive to that in Russia, because they have been invaded a number of times.
That's the troubling thing, is their society begins to decay, instead of thinking, it's our fault, let's do something. No, it's their fault, and we have to go after the outsiders.
Yeah.
So, and again, I thought of maybe doing something stupid.
That's troublesome.
It seems to me in the picture of the Antichrist, you have a combination of deception and coercion. You've got, on the one hand, the deception, the miracles, etc. And you certainly do have supernatural elements coming in. But on the other hand, you've got no one can buy and sell us at the market. That's one of the strong against the book, putting on some screws there. You don't have too much stability. I'm not sure you have too much stability. For some unknown reason, you've got the destruction of the Babylon by the Antichrist, although it's his students somewhere. Then you don't know for sure what to make of the others. Are all these guys coming from the east to help the Antichrist? Or are they coming against him? It depends on what scriptures you read together with which ones to see what you make out of that. Something I think to be on the lookout for that the Lewis, C.S. Lewis has been looking for a long time is an attempt to combine science and the occult in some way. And to me, some of that is already going on now, though most of it's in wacko circles. But yeah, that sort of thing. But I've seen an article or two in liberal journals suggesting an occult explanation for a phenomenon, which certainly been very unusual, what, 20 years ago? And some of those things are floating around now. Just hard to know where they're going.
Well, I think, you know, once in a while you hear people talking about the mark of the beast and so forth and so on. I think the plain fact is, in American society, it is now, practical purposes, everybody has a number. I mean, you know, anybody who wanted to put today, put together a computer system that would keep track, at least financially, of practically every transaction that goes on. With the credit cards and, I mean, with cash, I'd be interested in knowing what fraction of the total transactions are in cash. Especially except for the grocery bill and some small change stuff. But most big transactions are a check, which is done computer-wise. In fact, you know, one of the things I just read this past week, which was kind of interesting, is that the way the stock market watchdog determines whether there is manipulation of the stock market nowadays is by looking at trends in the buys and sells. And when they see, and they have automatic aberration checkers, when they see too much activity in this particular stock, or too many call or sell orders from a particular part of the country, then that keys investigation. So there you got one system, it's a relatively comprehensive system, which is, but there it is, completely automatic, and kind of keeping track of what's going on. So you can't, you couldn't get 30 people all buying a given stock without having to trigger an alarm. You know, 30 IBMs, it probably wouldn't make a difference. But that kind of surveillance is capable, is possible. And I think the fact is, we're in that society now, for practical purposes. Anytime anybody wants to do that, they can do it.
That's going to result in terrific political upheaval to try to do that type of thing. I mean, the climate of the country is not at this time such that somebody would be able to pull that off. There's more and more tendency now to want to decrease the amount of control.
Those are the conflicting trends. That's right. Yeah. That's why we don't have 1984.
Yeah.
Because we have these, which, you know, each one can be horrendous in itself. But maybe the conflicting trends, maybe in some sense, are God's gift to mankind or something like that. I don't know.
This is one reason why some kind of phenomenon that trigger an avalanche into a one-world government might change the situation very drastically.
Yeah.
Where you've got all these conflicting governments with conflicting desires and such, then you always have this balancing off. Somebody rises and falls and gets pushed down and such. But if a sequence of events, say nuclear war, set off a demand for everybody else to get together and have a one-world government, then you might begin to get some of those. And in reorganizing at that point, you might very well accidentally or intentionally build in some controls that hadn't been there. That's why many people, not all enthusiastic about a constitutional convention in our country now, is a lot of people aren't happy with the way it is.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be able to get big groups to agree on how to change it.
If you want to major controls, you do it in a period of upheaval.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, there are a number of phenomena on the horizon that you don't know which way they would go, but several of them could work that way. One of them would be some kind of energy crisis. One of them would be a nuclear war. One of them might be something like a trend towards heating of the earth or something with the CO2 layers and such. And lots of funny things going on that nobody knows where they're headed.
One of the things that really has me bothered as far as the Christian response goes, I think this is one we're really heading into, especially if you have an era of normalcy, and that is the whole subject of euthanasia and so forth. because we really indeed, as far as I can see, are indeed getting into a circumstance where you practically have to voluntarily, well, I mean, that's an extreme, but almost terminate life in order to die. I mean, you know, if you can prolong life almost arbitrarily. Question, what is the proper Christian appropriate response to this? Now, you know, you can do the Amish kind of response and say, boy, you just kind of isolate yourself and you don't take part in society, you refuse treatment like the Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that. But, you know, generally speaking, the Christian mass doesn't go along with that. So what do you do? I think there are answers with what you do, but I think the answers are ones which have to probably be worked out with the center government, which means the Christian involvement in this kind of decisions.
There's your big problem is our government has become, our society has become much, much more pluralistic in the last 20, 30 years. And the chances then of working out some of these policies everybody can agree on are getting much, much smaller. Much more disagreement about how to handle pornography today than there was 30 years ago. Much more disagreement about how to handle abortion than there was 30 years ago. So here we're getting into big crises that solutions need to be done for. And like, we can't agree on how to run a budget. Everybody agrees we ought not to spend more than we take in. But nobody agrees on what you ought to cut and what you ought to run with.
Well,
they've been having trouble even putting together a budget in the federal government for the last 5 or 10 years. They keep running on their own budgets.
Another trend, at least in government, is the trend for the legislature to more and more delegate legislation to the bureaucracies and the civil self. When you talk about what are the tax laws, to a certain extent, they're legislative by the Congress. To a large extent, they're interpretations of the IRS. And this goes with regulations as department after department after department. And I think this is a consequence of a huge government that the legislators can't, I mean, if we're going to spend 3 weeks in this church on school prayer, we obviously can't just spend it on another thing.
The bureaucrats aren't doing it, then the courts tell you what the legislators have in mind. I mean, courts become more legislative now.
On the policy side.
Yes.
I think that in the last 10 years, there's been considerable interest in Christian circles on what the Bible tells us about how society ought to run and how families ought to function and such. I think there's some really good work being done in that area that it's well to look into. The Journal of Christian Reconstruction has been running about 10 years now attempting to apply the Bible to economic problems, social problems, political problems, etc.
One of the greatest things is 666. By year 2000, we won't be controlled by a number and a card. There won't be no monetary situation. I was talking about a fellow today on that. In fact, it might be considered that the computer may be the Antichrist. It'll be controlling us.
I've heard that said. Yeah.
I think there's some other encouraging trends, too. 10, 15 years ago, to publicly state you were a Christian, you'd really be considered.
That's a consequence of the pluralistic society, you know, that if by saying opening it up to everybody, the Christians can take advantage of that and say, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids, for example, in school, they're very open. I mean, they can be very open in book reports about our position. And, you know, they're explaining the position.
Yeah.
They're explaining the position. I think Christians can take advantage of that.
Large
computer in Brussels, yeah.
Which controls the has everybody's number and so forth, and then most of the banks of the world now report into this computer and their assets and their debits and so forth.
Yeah, yes. I think the plain fact is, for practical purposes, we have a number. Everybody has a number. I mean, it's so easy to keep track of anybody who has a number. The fact is, we're very dependent on society. We've become so dependent on general commerce now. I just don't think there's any. The plain fact is, if somebody wants to use it as a hostile enemy, they can do it. I mean, that's all there is to it. There's no use even crying about it. I mean, that's a fact. Oh, it's all right there. Yeah, oh, sure. Sure.
What will we do with all the numbers that are missing from people who are raptured out?
Delete
No, I don't know too much about it either, but I spent some years since I read one of their books. They're supposed to have access to a horrendously big computer, and they program into it everything they can think of in society, and then they extrapolate it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, you know, now one area I do know something about is the subject of artificial intelligence. And that is trying to extract, you know, combine information, extract it. Except in very specific numerical stuff, like somebody's bank account, where is he now, and so forth and so on. It is very, 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 artificial intelligence is not yet at the point where it can really be doing that kind of stuff. To any insidious way, I don't think, that's my point, okay? I think the next generation or two, artificial intelligence will progress to the point where they can really start doing some dangerous, if you want to put it that way, or however you want to put it, thing. But I think that the power of what I call artificial intelligence, which is able, which means the ability to synthesize information and form conjectures about it and so on, is very primitive. And will be for the next one. It's a very, very tough problem. And actually, it's been hampered so far because we don't have a computer power. But in the next 20 years, the computer power is going to come. Now the question is, doing the work to do the artificial intelligence. That's a whole subject of itself. It's extremely interesting. But I don't think that artificial intelligence is able to do more than anything yet. Anything significant. I can even quote science to do it.
What happens to technology? What happens when research and development is done? Whether it's going to be used for good or for evil has been a problem all along. But the big problem now is the immense capability we have to handle information is so dangerous at this point.
Right.
But what is the Christian response? You stop technology?
Now, the Christian response, I think, to himself personally, has got to be aware of not being caught up themselves in aspirations which either depend on the government doing something that the government should not be in, that sort of thing.
You would disagree then with the government trying to get the baby bill filed?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I think that is a tragedy.
Yeah. I agree with you on that.
You mean the Baby Jane Doe? Or
Baby Jane.
Baby Jane.
See, the minute the government gets into a parental decision at that point, then it opens up all sorts of avenues that they could get into.
The trouble is, we're well-meaning. One of the things that really amazes me is that I was in Virginia for 3 years. This afternoon, you grew up in that area, I guess. The amazing thing to me is that there are people who are sincere Christians who really believe in the efficacy of the bureaucracy. They really believe that's the way to go. And, oh, my heavens. And they, you know, you can almost imagine a sincere Christian trying to pursue this Baby Jane Doe thing to the answer, you know. And I believe it's talented. But I think that basically boils down to the fact that a lot of Christians don't really stand back and think that they're doing it. I don't know.
So one approach would be to leave these type of decisions more and more with the individual.
As much as possible, leave things decentralized.
Okay. Including euthanasia, including whether somebody wants to pull a long way.
Especially decisions about life. And you know, this business, you've got to take out of the hands of the courts the arbitrary ability to just sort of say, take over parental control or take over. You know, like that's the case in Baby Jane Doe. They just want to take over custody. That can be abused so badly. And it's better to go to have the mistakes and the errors and the sins of the other extreme of child abuse or something like that, I think, in some respects, than to do some of those things. Yeah.
Well, if you limit the government too much, I guess it won't happen, but how could we prevent abortion other than by government decree at this point?
I think we've lost that.
Part of the problem I think we've got is that the society only works properly if people work properly. And secularists aren't willing to agree to that. And so they, whenever people don't work properly, they apply more controls. Yeah. And we're in a situation now where because of the collapse for most people of Christian morality, they don't believe and don't observe it. They are becoming more and more uncontrollable. We've got two alternatives. We've got anarchy. We've got government control. And nobody's done it. Not nobody. Very few people. The minority only can move for anarchy. That's what it's going to come down to. So our responsibility as Christians is clearly to, one, try and model what Christian behavior is and try and help other people see if that's really the solution to things. But we've got to realize that we as Christians are finite. And yes, a whole society can do things that bring the whole society down on our ears, even if we're doing the right things. But our responsibility is not to control everything, but God take care of that. Our responsibility is to operate the right way as well. But I think Christians can have influences, I think we can already see some of it in countries where Christian principles are stronger. You really do have a better lifestyle.
And I think that, harking back to my comment about what I thought about the world in 1970, I think it's even conceivable that the moral climate could change. It has happened in history. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something, you sort of get the feeling of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. But I think that is the challenge, maybe a challenge to Christians to pray and to work for a revival, or whatever you want to call it, a revival of morality. And those things can happen. They have happened in history. There have been times when things have been really the pits. And there have been revivals that have totally changed the climate for a century, for a long period of time.
Well, you better stop. Thank you very much.